Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Millions are facing hunger and children's lives are on the line in northeastern Nigeria amid a protracted conflict, UN humanitarians said on Wednesday. The UN's top humanitarian official in the country, Matthias Schmale, said that severe hunger affects 4.3 million people in Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe states. The number of children under 5 at risk of life-threatening severe acute malnutrition has doubled in 1 year to reach 700,000. Here is Mr. Schmale describing what he saw in the region.
I have been to Borno and the other two states several times. I've seen mothers fighting for the lives of their malnourished children in nutrition stabilization centers. I've spoken to children themselves who have been talking about being hungry for days. Those of us who are parents must imagine what it's like when you cannot ensure your children have enough to eat.
The catastrophic situation is primarily the result of more than a decade of insecurity linked to non-state armed groups, which prevents people from farming and earning income from the land, Mr. Schmale said. Climate change and soaring prices of food, fuel and fertilizers have exacerbated the crisis, and the response remains severely underfunded. The UN official said that out of the $1.3 billion in humanitarian funding needed for the region, only 25% has been secured so far. The number of people who've had to flee their homes because of the effects of climate change is rapidly increasing, but those who cross borders do not benefit from any legal protection. That's the message from the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Climate Change, Ian Fry, who told the Human Rights Council on Tuesday that in 2020 alone, 30.7 million people were displaced from their homes due to weather-related events, mainly drought. He warned that those people suffer from violations of their rights to food, water, sanitation, housing, health, education, and for some, their right to life. Here he is talking to UN News about possible legal remedies.
So these people fall through the cracks as far as current protection is concerned. I'm suggesting that we need to think about an international legal approach to deal with these people. And I'm suggesting that perhaps we could look at an optional protocol under the Refugee Convention to give legal protection to people displaced by climate change.
Mr. Fry also urged all countries to provide humanitarian visas for people displaced across international borders due to climate change as an interim measure. Staying with the dangers of displacement, countries' lack of compliance with international refugee law heightens risk of trafficking in persons, an independent UN-appointed rights expert said on Wednesday. Siobhan Mullally, the UN Special Rapporteur on Trafficking in Persons, warned that limiting access to asylum and other forms of international protection is likely to increase trafficking and exploitation risks by forcing people into precarious situations. She said that the increasing use of accelerated refugee status determination procedures, transfer of refugee status determination procedures to third countries, and the phenomenon of pushbacks following interceptions at sea or land borders undermine states' ability to comply with their obligations to identify, assist, and protect victims of trafficking, and to respect the principle of non-refoulement. The Special Rapporteur also noted that many of the countries hosting the highest number of refugees and internally displaced persons have limited capacity to prevent trafficking and to protect victims. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
Good afternoon, listeners. Boy, that's right. That's coming up tomorrow on Friday. Free Thought Friday here at Radio Free Kansas. I'm your host, Mike Adell, the hostess with the mostest. I'm trying to give you something real on a day that is a scorcher. You talk about real. It is real out here, I'm telling you. 30 miles to the west of us in the beautiful city of Topeka. It's 102 degrees estimated this afternoon. A heat index of 106. And it's only 1 degree difference between there and here. So it's going to be a scorcher of a day. And however, we do not have the haze I anticipated from the major news media today. Evidently, Chicago, I've seen the before and after photographs of the windy city. It's not windy enough. It's not windy enough in Chicago, I'll tell you that. Because the haze, man, it looks like, well, it reminds me of L.A. in the 1970s or the 60s or the 50s. Smog, man, serious haze. We don't have that here. Thank goodness. We had some real wind coming out of the south, about 10 miles per hour. But that's just like a furnace bake, you know? You get 10 mile per hour winds out of the south, hot winds, hot, coming in, and you just might as well just kiss your ass goodbye outside. So if this is your listening post at lunchtime, I hope it is. I hope you're staying out of the sun and taking care of yourself if you have to be out in it. That's to all the working gals and guys out there who have to go out into this heat to earn a living. On the labor front news, it is breaking. Fears are on the legacy media and the mainstream financial news networks. The Teamsters have walked out of negotiations with the UPS shippers. And there's a good chance that you may see a strike. And it's always a good one when the Teamsters get involved in strikes. It's always a good one, I'm telling you, speaking as an ex-member of the union. It's going to be a controversial because not all truck drivers anymore. The Teamsters union has branched out in the last 20, 30 years to not only being more democratic, but also across shops and crafts. I mean, you've got people who work in grocery stores that are in the Teamster Union. So it will be very interesting to see how solidarity plays out. If you do happen to see a picket line and you absolutely have to cross it, stop and talk with them. And, you know, don't let them get you all riled up, and don't you rile them up. Just stop and talk to the picketers holding those strike signs out in front of the gates. They're not going to hurt you. You can go in, give them the common courtesy of a hat tip and a short talk. Slow down whatever the hell you're doing when you're crossing picket lines. Let's see. In the second hour, we're going to try something new. It's called Between the Lines. It's not new to me, but it's new to you. It comes out of WBAI. New York City radio, community radio, just as Law and Disorder. Same station, different studios. And in the second hour, we're going to try Between the Lines, the great news radio show. Coming up is Democracy Now! We've got the latest issue this morning. I got it up. This morning's top U.S. and world headlines at Democracy Now! It's good stuff, news you can use with your comrades out there where you work. See it. I'll see you on tomorrow, Friday. And by the way, remember this. I mean, Friday in the afternoon in the second hour on Free Thought Friday, we have This Way Out, which is the world. It's really a global LGBTQ radio magazine. That's in the second hour tomorrow afternoon on Radio Free Kansas. So I hope you have a great day, and check in with you tomorrow. Tristan, let's get her on. See ya.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Smoke from nearly 500 wildfires in Canada is blanketing much of North America in an unprecedented haze, triggering air quality alerts in 20 U.S. states that are home to a third of the population. On Wednesday, the EPA's air quality index for major cities, including Chicago, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Milwaukee, Pittsburgh, and Toronto, reached unhealthy or very unhealthy levels as city skylines faded into a shroud of smoky air. Air pollution near Detroit reached hazardous levels. Meanwhile, over 100 million people across the United States are under heat warnings and watches today as a heat dome that's lingered over Texas expands to southeastern states and parts of California brace for triple-digit temperatures. We'll have the latest on Canada's wildfires and the climate crisis later in the broadcast. In Sudan, heavy fighting's resumed around the capital, Khartoum, despite declared ceasefires marking the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Adha. Fighting between Sudan's army and the rival Rapid Support Forces is heaviest in Sudan's most populous city, Omdurman, where residents report airstrikes and fierce anti-aircraft fire in civilian-populated areas. The UN says 10 weeks of heavy clashes in Sudan and ethnically motivated killings in the western region of Darfur have displaced nearly 2.8 million people. In France, anger over the police killing of a 17-year-old boiled over into protests for a second straight night in over a dozen cities. Protesters set fire to cars, trash cans, police stations, and launched fireworks at officers who responded with volleys of tear gas. France's interior minister said 150 people have been arrested. Some 2,000 riot police were called up in suburbs around Paris, including in Nanterre, where the teen, who's been identified only by the name Nahel M, was shot dead Tuesday after he was pulled over for allegedly breaking traffic rules. Video posted on social media contradicts the claims of police who initially reported one officer shot the teen for driving his car directly at them. Instead, the video shows two officers standing beside the vehicle. One of them points a gun as a voice is heard saying, "You're going to get a bullet in the head." The officer then fires at close range as the boy drives off. French President Emmanuel Macron called the teen's killing unexplainable and inexcusable. Macron also said the resulting protests were, quote, absolutely unjustifiable. French Prime Minister Elisabeth Borne condemned the actions of officers.
The shocking images broadcast yesterday show an intervention that clearly does not seem to comply with the rules of engagement of our law enforcement officers.
The UN Security Council has called for restraint on all sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict amid surging violence in the occupied West Bank. On Tuesday, U.S. Deputy Ambassador to the United Nations Robert Wood offered a rare diplomatic rebuke of Israel over the demolition of Palestinian homes and the incitement to violence by elected officials in Israel.
We are also deeply troubled by Israel's recent announcement advancing more than 5,000 settlement units and reports of changes to Israel's system of settlement administration that expedite the planning and approval of settlements.
The U.S. Navy says it will station its largest nuclear-armed submarine in South Korea for the first time in four decades. This comes after the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol and President Joe Biden agreed to a deal in April in which South Korea agreed not to develop its own nuclear weapons in exchange for a more aggressive U.S. nuclear posture toward North Korea. President Joe Biden's holding a pair of fundraisers with wealthy donors in New York today ahead of the Federal Election Commission's June 30th disclosure deadline. On Wednesday, Biden flew to Chicago for a fundraiser with deep-pocketed Democratic donors at the home of Illinois' billionaire governor, J.B. Pritzker. Biden also used his Chicago trip to tout his administration's handling of the U.S. economy, embracing the label Bidenomics as a brand for his 2024 reelection campaign. Back in the United States, several sheriff's deputies in Rankin County, Mississippi, have been fired after two black men filed a lawsuit alleging torture and attempted sexual assault by officers. Michael Jenkins and Eddie Parker say six deputies entered their home outside Jackson in January and handcuffed, kicked, and waterboarded them, taunted them with racist slurs, attempted sexual assault, and repeatedly electrocuted them with tasers. Jenkins says one deputy placed a gun into his mouth and pulled the trigger, lacerating his tongue and shattering severing his jaw. The men are seeking $400 million in damages from Rankin County Sheriff Brian Bailey and six deputies. The FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, and the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division have opened investigations. Here in New York, a white former U.S. Marine who choked black street performer Jordan Neely to death on a subway train has pleaded not guilty to charges of second-degree manslaughter and criminally negligent homicide. Daniel Penny entered the plea at his arraignment in Manhattan court Wednesday before walking free on $100,000 bail. His next court appearance is October 25th. A legal defense fund set up by Penny's lawyers has raised nearly $3 million. Speaking outside the courthouse after Penny's arraignment, Neely family lawyer Dante Mills promised justice.
Daniel Penny killed a man. He took a life. And for everyone who thought donating $3 million would somehow make this go away or buy his pass, it's not going to happen. It didn't work. You can ask for a refund. We're here. Help is here. So from now on, when justice happens, don't be surprised and don't be shocked.
The Biden administration's dropped its civil rights investigation into whether air pollution regulators discriminated against black communities in an industrial section of Louisiana known as Cancer Alley. Some 200 petrochemical plants span the majority black region over an 80-mile stretch of the Mississippi River. On Tuesday, the Environmental Protection Agency said in a court filing it had uncovered no finding of discrimination or other violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That's despite initial findings that Louisiana environmental and health officials failed to provide accurate information to residents about airborne emissions of chloroprene, a hazardous chemical linked to lung and liver cancer. The Belgian chemical company Solvay has agreed to pay nearly $400 million to settle claims linked to drinking water contamination near its factory in southern New Jersey. The funds will be used to clean up pollution caused by PFAS, a class of toxic substances commonly called forever chemicals that don't break down in the environment or in the human body. PFAS have been linked to cancer, liver and thyroid disease, maternal mortality, birth defects, and other health problems. Wednesday's settlement comes a week after 3M agreed to pay more than $10 billion to settle lawsuits claiming it knowingly used forever chemicals in its products despite risks to human health. This comes as Republican Congress members are promoting legislation that would weaken attempts to regulate PFAS while insulating many polluters from liability under the federal Superfund law. The United States has recorded its first cases of domestically transmitted malaria for the first time in two decades. Dr. Deborah Howery, the chief medical officer at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, said Tuesday the mosquito-borne disease was discovered in four people from Florida and one person in Texas.
So it's a concern because malaria is a life-threatening disease. It's not often seen in the United States, and we haven't seen it domestically acquired in over 20 years.
In 2021, malaria infected nearly a quarter billion people, killing more than 600,000 of them around the world. The disease is triggered by a parasite that's spread to humans by certain types of mosquitoes that thrive in warm weather and humid conditions. In recent years, those mosquitoes have expanded their ranges in ways that are consistent with climate change. And the head of the Teamsters Union says a third of a million workers at UPS will likely walk off the job August 1st after slamming the shipping company's proposed union contract as appalling. Teamsters President Sean M. O'Brien said in a statement, quote, "The largest single employer strike in American history now appears inevitable. Executives at UPS, some of whom get tens of millions of dollars a year, do not care about the hundreds of thousands of American workers who make this company run," he said. The Teamsters are demanding UPS exchange its last, best, and final offer no later than Friday. Earlier this month, 97% of unionized UPS workers voted to authorize a nationwide strike if managers don't agree to a new union contract by July 31st. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote our entire show to the issue of exploring ways to achieve peace in the Ukraine-Russia war.
First, we speak with political analyst Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies about achieving a ceasefire and negotiations in this war.
We also speak with Medea Benjamin from Code Pink, who's just returned to the United States.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. 16 months ago, Russia launched an illegal invasion of Ukraine, albeit in the context of a history of threats to its security by NATO countries. It is estimated that as of February, Russia has suffered nearly 190,000 to 223,000 casualties, and Ukraine has suffered nearly 125,000 to 130,000 casualties. Meanwhile, the United States and its allies continue to provide Ukraine with all the weapons it requests and impose increasingly harsh sanctions on Russia. But there appears to be little appetite in the U.S. for a ceasefire and negotiations to end the bloodshed. Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, focusing on Middle East, U.S. wars, and U.N. issues. She is also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. Phyllis has written frequent articles and been interviewed many times about how to achieve peace in Ukraine. We are fortunate to have Phyllis with us today to discuss what must happen to end Russia's war in Ukraine and the prospects for peace. Phyllis Bennis, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Please tell our listeners what must be done to achieve peace in Ukraine.
You know, that's a much harder question than it perhaps should be, because real peace, of course, means peace with justice. That's a very long process looking forward. But I think the question that we need to answer immediately is, how do we stop the killing? How do we stop the fighting in Ukraine? That won't mean peace right away, but it's an important step towards peace, which means we need a ceasefire, we need negotiations, even before we get to a long-term peace. And that means first we have to stop the killing and start the talking. There are examples where negotiations could go forward while the fighting continues. Some people say, well, we can't have a ceasefire now, but we should go to negotiations. The best-known example, perhaps, might be Vietnam. Between 1968 and 1973, the United States and the Vietnamese negotiated, but the fighting continued, and there were, I would imagine, more than a million Vietnamese killed during those years and thousands of U.S. soldiers. So it's not necessarily the model that we want to look to. I would say that we need a ceasefire immediately, and we need to start talking. And there's a particular urgency because of the danger of a nuclear escalation in this war, the kind of danger that we really haven't seen, at least since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Even in situations like in Syria, where the U.S. and Russia had soldiers both on the ground and in the air, faced off on different sides, but there was not this kind of danger that was ever going to escalate to a nuclear confrontation. This time there is. There's no Syria-style military-to-military hotline that can prevent misunderstandings or mistaken escalations. There's none of that. And it means there is a terrible danger that this war could really escalate to a nuclear exchange between the world's two biggest nuclear powers, and it could result in absolute catastrophe.
Well, Phyllis, Ukrainian President Zelensky has said there will be no negotiations as long as there is one Russian soldier left in Ukraine. Can you tell us what the obstacles to a ceasefire and negotiations are? And what role the United States has played in preventing a diplomatic solution to the war?
There are really a bunch of obstacles, Heidi, that we need to think about. Both sides at various points have said, we will not negotiate until something happens that reflects something that is more appropriate to be the end of negotiations rather than the beginning of a ceasefire. But on the other hand, there have been negotiations that have succeeded. There have been negotiations that led to the grain agreement. There were negotiations that led to several different large-scale prisoner exchanges. So the two sides, while they have maintained the rhetoric of we won't negotiate until X happens, they have in fact been negotiating. There are, however, clearly obstacles to a ceasefire. Both sides think that they can do better in negotiations if conditions on the ground at the time of a ceasefire are more favorable to them. But that, of course, kind of ignores what a ceasefire is. A ceasefire means a ceasefire in place to allow talks to go forward towards a permanent peace. It doesn't mean that the ceasefire represents the end game of what a permanent peace will look like. The stakes are just too high because of the nuclear danger and other things, but most of all the nuclear danger, along with the huge number of civilians that are being killed in Ukraine. So on the question of that's on the question of ceasefire. On the question of negotiations, there are different reasons that each side has for defining why the other side is at war. The notion that the Russian invasion was illegal. Russia claims that Ukraine doesn't exist as an independent state. It wants to protect Russian language speakers. It wants to eliminate the Nazis that are in control in Ukraine. These are all false claims. In Ukraine, on their side, they had negotiated earlier, as I mentioned. They were moving towards more serious negotiations towards a peace agreement. This was back in April of last year, April of 2022. And at the last minute, they were persuaded not to go forward with those negotiations, mainly in the context of a visit by Boris Johnson, then the Prime Minister of the UK, who was clearly acting on behalf of the US and its NATO and other European allies, offering the full promise of absolute unlimited military backing, and saying, we don't want you to negotiate now, we don't want you to feel like you need to negotiate now, and we will provide everything you need to continue this war. Now it's even harder, I think, to imagine a ceasefire because so much has been lost. So many people have been killed, so many more have been injured, so many have been dispossessed, whole cities have been destroyed, and Ukraine is saying that they won't negotiate until Russia pulls out. That position, of course, reflects the reality of Russia's violation of international law, that it is illegally occupying another country, but it's not a realistic definition of what it would take to begin a ceasefire or to begin negotiations. So there's a lot of contradictions here in terms of how the various sides are identifying what's the goal of a ceasefire. Does a ceasefire reflect what will be the final solution? And the answer is no, of course it doesn't. It's a first step towards serious negotiations. But you need that first step, in this case, certainly, to stop the killing. That's what has to happen. Stop the killing, start the talking. And that doesn't mean it's going to be quick or easy. But without a ceasefire, it's going to be far more difficult to even begin negotiations.
Phyllis, do you think that the Biden administration has encouraged or discouraged a diplomatic solution to the war?
Well, in words, they have been rather neutral. They've said there should be negotiations, but not until the conditions are absolutely the best possible for Ukraine. And in the meantime, we will continue providing Ukraine with all the weapons they want. In practice, what that means is they have sent a very clear message to Ukraine. There's no reason for you to engage in a ceasefire, to call for a ceasefire in place, or, frankly, to begin negotiations, because we will continue to back you in this war, and that means providing all the different weapons that they've wanted. Each of the weapons requested by Ukraine at first was resisted by the U.S. government. And then as European countries came on board and said, well, we'll provide some of that, but really it's the U.S. that has more of them, whether it was strategic tanks, whether it was strategic missiles, whether it was now the possibility of F-16s, which the U.S. hasn't yet officially said we're going to provide the planes, but they have now given permission to all their European allies to provide the bombers, and the U.S. has said we will provide the training. That's just one step away from saying we'll provide more planes themselves. So in all of those ways, the message from the United States is similar to that that was made much more explicitly by Boris Johnson. There's no reason to move towards a ceasefire or negotiations. Instead, we will provide all the weapons possible to improve your situation on the ground when you start negotiations. They don't even make the claim that these advanced weapons are going to make it possible for Ukraine to actually win the war, to militarily expel all the Russian troops from Ukrainian territory. I think what we're seeing is that right now the war is at the state of a war of attrition. Neither side is capable of fully winning this war in the sense of a full defeat where the other side surrenders. We're not going to see that. And the question is, how many more Ukrainian civilians, how many more Russian soldiers that are forced into conscription are going to have to die before we get to the inevitable question of a ceasefire on the ground and negotiations to actually end the war and create some kind of a peace with justice that can last.
What effect, if any, do you think that the increasingly repressive sanctions that NATO countries have placed on Russia is helping or hurting to end the war?
I don't think they do much to end the war. The sanctions, like economic sanctions in so many places, have a much greater impact on the population that they do on governments, particularly powerful repressive governments like the Russian government, which makes sure that its own people are largely protected. Some of the sanctions, of course, are individual targeted sanctions against specific wealthy Russian individuals with economic power outside the country, and that can have some impact over time in terms of individual wealthy Russians close to Putin not being able to get access to their yachts, to their bank accounts, etc. But I think the notion that that is somehow having a military impact so far, we certainly have seen no indication of it. And what happens is it makes it that much more difficult for Russia to find, if there are forces around Putin, and I don't think we actually know whether there are or not, if there are forces around Putin who are trying to find some kind of what they like to call an off-ramp, we are making that much more difficult by keeping these sanctions in place. I don't think it weakens the Russian military. The Russian military has clearly not had the kind of training and weapons that it was once believed they did. But what they do have in enormous numbers is a population with a huge number of young men that are subject to conscription with or without decent training, with or without decent weapons, who are sent off as cannon fodder. And that can continue for an awfully long time. Russia is a way bigger population than that of Ukraine. So the notion that these sanctions are somehow going to actually impact the nature of the war, I think, is simply not the case.
Phyllis, the Chinese put forth a 12-point program for achieving peace in the Russia-Ukraine war. What did it say, and why wasn't it adopted?
Well, the question of what it said, the Chinese proposal, like some of the others that have been floating around, is more a principles. It's a set of ideas and principles that should be the basis for a solution. It talks about respecting the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity of Ukraine, which would imply a Russian withdrawal, but it didn't call for a Russian withdrawal. It called for both sides to abandon a Cold War mentality, which the Chinese position was that neither side should be pursuing its own security at the expense of others, including by expanding military blocs. That was a direct call on the United States to end the expansion of NATO, which has been going on since 1991. It called for a ceasefire, although it didn't use the word, but it said that both sides should avoid fanning the flames and should prevent the crisis from spiraling out of control. They talked about resuming peace talks, referencing the earlier peace talks that had been underway last year, easing the humanitarian crisis, protecting civilians, abiding by international humanitarian law, which are the laws of war. There was an expressed concern about the nuclear power plants, keeping them safe, implementing the initiative around grain, reducing the strategic risk, in which they talked directly, the Chinese talked directly about making sure that nuclear weapons are not used, that nuclear wars are never fought, opposing the threat to nonproliferation that this war represents. So it goes on with a set of very useful principles. It's not exactly a timetable of what either a ceasefire or negotiations would look like, how they would actually begin, under whose auspices. Would it be under the auspices of the United Nations or some other international force? But I think what was more important in terms of why it wasn't adopted full bore had less to do with what it called for. These are all principles that I think all sides would largely agree with. There was concern from the U.S. side that they didn't explicitly say that there needs to be a withdrawal of Russian troops. They did, however, call for respect for the sovereignty, independence, and territorial integrity, which certainly implies that. but it's more a question of who was putting it forward. The fact that it was coming from China, in terms of the view of Ukraine and its U.S. and European allies, means this is a country that has, to a large degree, not entirely, but to a large degree, indicated support only for the Russian side. It has called for an end to the war, etc., but its strategic relations are clearly much closer to Russia. Its relations with Ukraine are limited to powerful economic ties, but very relatively much weaker ties that are either strategic or political. So the question was more about who was putting it forward than what it actually called for. Many of these ideas will certainly be part of the process of finding a ceasefire and ultimately negotiations when it finally happens, but it probably won't be accepted in this form because it came from China rather than for what it actually said or didn't say.
Well, Phyllis, Vladimir Putin just hosted representatives from 7 African countries, and they have a 10-point peace plan. Does that provide a workable way forward?
Well, like the Chinese model, the points from the African Peace Mission, as it was known, are largely points of principle. Again, they don't directly call for a ceasefire or state what a final status of after negotiations would look like, what it would lead to. It's like the Chinese proposal in that way. Again, the ideas that they have are important, that both the leaders of both sides must be listening to each other directly, that the war needs to be settled through negotiations and diplomacy rather than militarily, that there needs to be a de-escalation of conflict. That's as close as they got to a direct call for a ceasefire. They talked about the sovereignty of countries being recognized in the context of the UN Charter and international legal principles. They interestingly said something the Chinese didn't mention, which is the call for a guarantee of security for all the countries involved. And that means not only Russia and Ukraine, but the surrounding countries as well. So the question of what security guarantees for Ukraine might look like if it did not actually enter NATO would be a major question. They talked about implementing the grain initiative. That's of particular importance to African countries because it's Africa and parts of South Asia that have been the primary victims of the cutoff in access to grain and fertilizer from both Russia and Ukraine throughout this war. They also talked about humanitarian efforts being escalated, POWs being released, the children returned to Ukraine. That was an important one because that was something that was seen by Ukraine as a potential war crime. The movement of children from areas that Russian soldiers controlled even temporarily into Russian territory, holding them in various schools and camps and threatening to put some of them up for adoption if their parents did not come and claim them in a way that's very, very difficult to impossible for many Ukrainian parents. So the fact that the African Initiative called explicitly for returning the children to Ukraine was, I think, quite important. They talked about reconstruction, which is interesting given the disparity of concern about raising money internationally for the reconstruction of the destruction of in other wars, particularly the wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Somalia, in Libya, and elsewhere, including, again, in African countries. For the African countries to be calling for a major focus on the need for reconstruction, that was significant. And then they talked about further dialogue and said that they, the African peace mission, would be willing to participate in that. I think, again, the question of how it's received has less to do with the specific principles than it does with who is raising it. In this case, the initiative came first from the president of South Africa, President Cyril Ramaphosa, and the problem that was faced was that the African leaders that he engaged in this process largely came from African countries that are not seen globally as internationally significant players diplomatically. They are not either wealthy countries or strategically significant, and it was important for Ramaphosa, I think, to do this in the name of Africa as a continent, but in terms of the kind of pressure that it puts on either Russia or Ukraine is quite limited, I think, in terms of which African countries were involved. The Egyptian president, for example, was one of three among the seven who pulled out at the last minute and sent lower-ranking officials. So the four presidents, other than Ramaphosa himself, did not represent powerful countries, and I think that's, unfortunately, a significant limitation on how seriously it will be taken.
My co-host Heidi Boghossian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with Phyllis Bennis, an expert analyst, about how to achieve peace in Ukraine.
Phyllis, who do you think is in the best position to broker a ceasefire and negotiations?
It's a really hard question. I think that the dream team diplomatically might be made up of President Ramaphosa from South Africa and President Lula of Brazil, perhaps with the President of India, although that brings up a bunch of problematic problems for those of us who work on issues of human rights and legitimacy and things like that, but to bring Modi into something like this. But some combination there in terms of who represents the majority of people in the world, that would make a lot of sense. Obviously, whoever is in that position is going to have to be accepted not only by both sides, by the governments of Ukraine and Russia, but also by the backers of Ukraine. Ukraine is being treated very much as if it were part of NATO already, although it is not, and there is not a plan to invite it to join immediately anytime soon. But the level of support that's being provided to Ukraine, more than $70 billion just from the United States in military support alone, and tens of billions more in economic support, indicates a very close strategic relationship. So that means that the people that are being looked to broker a ceasefire and hold these negotiations are going to have to be approved by very powerful forces. So I think that the diplomatic dream team of Ramaphosa and Lula, maybe with Modi as well, are in that best position. Whether the U.S. and Russia, for that matter, would accept that, I think, is still an open question. But the longer the war goes on, the more Ukrainians are killed, the more the threat of a possible nuclear escalation, even if that isn't the intention, which I believe it is not, of either the United States or Russia, the escalation that can happen in this kind of a war presents a dire threat. It may be a tiny threat, but when you're talking about nuclear escalation, any threat that is not absolute zero is simply too big to risk.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine violated the UN Charter and constitutes a war of aggression, but you claim there are really two wars being waged in Ukraine. Can you please explain that?
Sure. You know, there was a geopolitical war that began in 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And I would say the U.S. and NATO are certainly the aggressor in that geopolitical war. It's primarily being fought politically, at least until 2014, but mainly politically, not militarily, where you had the expansion of NATO, the positioning of nuclear weapons across Europe, the positioning of strategic weapons very close to Russia's border, very provocative moves. The ground war is a separate war that began in February of 2022, where Russia is clearly the aggressor. It was not unprovoked, but it is still illegal. The response to provocation does not have to be an aggressive war. Russia chose to wage an aggressive war, and it's responsible for the war, the horrific war that has happened. So there needs to be an end to that war. There needs to be a withdrawal of Russian troops. But I think that we have to be very careful in making clear that while the charges of U.S.-NATO provocation all these years is absolutely true, it's also absolutely true that Russia has been the aggressor in this ground war that is itself responsible for the deaths of so many thousands of people, both in Ukraine and among Russian soldiers. That's what's got to end.
Well, it's a very frightening situation, and Phyllis, thank you so much for helping our listeners to try to understand this complex situation. How can our listeners follow your work?
The website for the Institute for Policy Studies is ips-dc.org, and they can look for my work or that of the New Internationalism Project.
Well, thank you so much, and this war is not going to end anytime soon, I'm afraid, and I'm sure we will have you back.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, peace groups from around the world convened on June 10th and 11th in Vienna, Austria. Their mission was to discuss creative solutions and to promote negotiations to the Russia-Ukraine war. Groups included the International Peace Bureau, Code Pink, Europe for Peace, the International Fellowship for Reconciliation, Peace in Ukraine Coalition, the Campaign for Peace, Disarmament, and Common Security, and several Austrian peace groups. Conference attendees grappled with controversial issues related to Russia's aggressive invasion of Ukraine. Representatives discussed the devastating consequences of the war on their countries. The conference concluded with an urgent global appeal, the Vienna Declaration for Peace, calling on all sides to work toward a ceasefire and negotiations. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Ann Wright noted, quote, "For those of us in the U.S., it is important to remind our elected leaders that we want peace in our world, not war, and for them to get moving on peace talks." The former U.S. diplomat added, "The U.S. is a belligerent in this war, just like Russia and Ukraine, and our taxes are funding the deaths of Ukrainians and Russians." Joining us today to talk about efforts to achieve diplomacy over bloodshed in Ukraine is Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the international anti-war organization Code Pink. She's the author of several books, including with Nicholas J.S. Davies, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict.
Medea Benjamin, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hello, how wonderful to be on with you.
Well, Medea, you've recently attended the International Summit for Peace in Vienna, for which Code Pink was one of the organizers. Was the event a success, and where are you now?
The event was a great success. It was a little touch and go towards the end because Austria, which is a neutral country, unbeknownst to the organizers in Austria, got a lot of pushback at the last minute. In fact, the Confederation of Trade Unions of Austria that was going to host the conference got cold feet because the ambassador from Ukraine said that we were a bunch of Putin apologists and they shouldn't host the conference. And 2 days before, they canceled, as did the press club that was supposed to be where we were going to do our press conference. And so we had a scramble at the last minute, but we did find alternative locations. Hundreds of people came from 32 different countries, and it was quite an extraordinary experience to exchange ideas, exchange ways of organizing, learn from each other. And so I would say it was a great success. And in terms of where I am now, I'm with retired Colonel Ann Wright. She and I decided to stay in Europe and travel through Eastern Europe first to get a feel of what the pulse is like. We were after Austria, we went to Slovakia, then to Poland, and now we are in Ukraine. And we thought it's very important to come here to talk to people and to really get a more well-rounded understanding of what are the possibilities for ending this conflict.
Well, Medea, we can't wait to hear your report once you leave Ukraine and return to the U.S. What were your key takeaways from the International Summit for Peace, including the Vienna Declaration of Peace?
The Vienna Declaration had to be watered down, according to some people who wanted it to include things like criticism of NATO, because in some countries, that would just narrow the coalition and force the representatives not to sign on to it, and we thought unity was most important. So it was a very basic declaration that made it clear how important it was to move to a ceasefire in negotiations. And I think one of the takeaways was how repressive the atmosphere is, not just in Austria, but throughout Europe, particularly in Eastern Europe, and certainly for people in the most affected countries, Ukraine and Russia, to be speaking out for peace. In fact, the panel that we had with people from those two countries turned out afterwards, we had to really work to make sure that they were protected because they got so much pushback. The Russians for saying also that there needed to be peace talks. Nobody from the governments in this region wants to hear that. They really continue with the same myth we hear in the United States that victory is possible. And so we have really been surprised at in the countries that call themselves democracies, there's even a more repressive atmosphere than in the United States. Like when we told people, oh, we've taken out ads in U.S. newspapers to get our message across and saying how awful it is that we had to resort to that because we couldn't get our op-ed published, they would say, oh my goodness, we could never get an ad published. The newspapers would never allow that. So yes, it's a very narrow opening for discussion about this war.
Medea, please remind our listeners what Code Pink is and what does its name signify?
Code Pink started out before the invasion of Iraq after George Bush had declared that color-coded alert system, yellow, orange, red, to keep people in a state of fear and justify the invasion of Iraq. And we had declared a Code Pink to say that we needed to respond in a different manner. And that's the origins of Code Pink. And ever since then, we've been working hard to try to work towards reducing militarism in this country and reducing wars and occupations as ways of dealing with international conflicts. We also have gotten involved more recently with the issue of economic sanctions, since that's become another kind of warfare that the U.S. is using in hurting so many people in many countries. So that's the origin and some of the focuses of Code Pink.
Well, Medea, you and Code Pink seem to turn up anywhere resistance to oppression is needed, and we are so grateful for your work. You've said that the push for a peaceful solution to the Russia-Ukraine war is not just the task of states and diplomats, but increasingly the task of global civil society. Could you please elaborate on that?
Well, yes, and especially when it comes to the United States, because we feel that there is no initiative coming from the White House or coming from Congress to try to push for negotiations. While certainly it's coming from other heads of state, like in China and Brazil and South Africa and the Pope, but not in the United States. And so we feel that these people's initiatives, and this is true in the NATO countries as well, since there is so far a sense among the NATO countries that there is unity, that the people in these countries are fine with this war dragging out, and that's why there is such an important role that grassroots citizens can play. We hear from our members of Congress that they're getting very few calls on this issue, which is why we encourage people to constantly be calling their members of Congress. And it's unfortunate we're not at the point right now where we can mobilize large numbers of people, but our friends in Europe are able to do that. We have the example in Italy, where they've brought over 100,000 people out in the streets to call for peace talks. The Czech Republic has brought tens of thousands of people out. So we are, you know, inspired by what other countries are doing, and we feel that we in the U.S. have to educate people, have to open up this space for dialogue, and have to make our determination known to both our representatives in Congress and people in the White House.
Medea, in your recent book, War in Ukraine, Making Sense of a Senseless Conflict, you and Nicholas Davies provide a historical context for this war. Although you note that Russia's invasion of Ukraine was illegal, you also describe the dangerous role that NATO has played leading up to that invasion. Please elaborate for our listeners.
Well, yes, we elaborate in our book the numerous examples of experts, of diplomats, of academics who said way back, starting at the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union, this is a bad idea, and actually predicted that it would lead to war. We have even the person who is now the head of the CIA, Nicholas Burns, who said it very loud and clear and said it wasn't just Putin. It was the entire elite in Russia at that time who said this is a red line that cannot be crossed. So this was a war foretold, and unfortunately NATO did nothing to try to stop it. And right now we have the example of NATO that's going to be meeting in Vilnius very soon, and they are walking this real tightrope because Ukrainians want to be able to join NATO now. The Eastern Europeans are very much in favor of that. And the Western Europeans are saying, wait a minute, you can't join while there's a war going on. And they know that this would be a clear indication that the war will continue because Russia just will not accept that. So I think both the Russians and NATO have found themselves in a bind where Ukraine is in the middle of all this. They're simply trying to support their sovereignty and their people, and yet they are caught in the middle between the NATO countries that have promised them membership in the past and Russia that says absolutely no.
Why would it be dangerous for Ukraine to join NATO?
Because Russia says that that is absolutely prohibited to have a border surrounded by a country that is in a hostile military alliance, that could have NATO forces on its soil, that could have weapons, including nuclear weapons, based in its territory, that this is just totally unacceptable. And, you know, they have said at many times, yet means yet, no means no. And you wonder when the NATO countries will actually listen to that. There are many guarantees that NATO countries can give to Ukraine without joining, giving them membership. And in fact, that's something that is going to be talked about at the upcoming NATO summit. But certainly this idea of incorporating Ukraine into NATO, it would be a terrible move on behalf of the West.
Critics of NATO are labeled as Russian sympathizers. How do you answer that claim?
We say that's ridiculous because many of us have been opposed to NATO for decades now. We've been part of an organization called Say No to NATO. We have been against NATO not just because it's provocative in terms of Russia, but also because of the aggressive actions that NATO has taken in places that are thousands of miles away from the North Atlantic, like NATO's involvement in the invasion of Afghanistan, NATO's involvement in the invasion and overthrow of the government of Libya, and the NATO hostility towards China. We also think it's part of the militarization of our world. There is a goal in NATO that you're supposed to spend 2% of your GDP on the military, which is horrific because as we talk to people in Europe as we're traveling around, they say we don't want to be like the United States that doesn't have a decent healthcare system, its education system is falling apart. We support our healthcare system and our education system, and we won't be able to keep them going if we put more and more money into the military. Unfortunately, Russia's invasion has given a new lease on life to NATO and a new justification for the NATO countries to be spending more on their military. But it's a aggressive military alliance. And I think hopefully once this war is over, we can get more people involved in the campaign to try to dismantle this alliance that should have been dismantled at the time of the breakup of the Soviet Union.
Medea, many in the United States dismiss the word peace and the push for negotiations as an alternative to war as naive. Do you think it's possible to change that perception? And if so, how do we do that?
I think the facts on the ground will change that perception. You know, we've seen in leaked documents that the Pentagon itself said that not only does Russia have terrible deficiencies when it comes to munitions and the trained personnel, but the Ukraine does. And that no matter this patchwork of armaments that the different countries of NATO are sending, the leaked document says that they doubt that there will be any significant change on the ground in the counteroffensive that's going on right now. And the leaked documents came to the conclusion that this is a stalemate, that this is a war of attrition. And so as time goes by, and perhaps as we move more directly into the presidential election cycle, more and more politicians are going to become aware that this is becoming less and less popular, that there's not going to be an easy victory, and that maybe the best thing is to find an off-ramp, not only for Putin, but for Zelensky and for United States and the NATO countries. And so that's why I think it's important to be building up this opposition or building up the support for peace talks so that as we move forward and this realization becomes evident, that we will have an ability to really help set the agenda for peace talks.
My co-host Heidi Boghossian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with Code Pink's Medea Benjamin about the recent International Summit for Peace held in Vienna. Medea, can you give an example or two of how pressure from ordinary people and communities has resulted in diplomatic solutions?
There are many, many examples throughout history. One very famous one, because won the Nobel Peace Prize, is the women of Liberia and how they helped to end a civil war that went on for over a decade, and how mothers and wives and daughters came together and said, we're not going to allow our men to keep fighting each other. So that was one beautiful example. And there are many others here in the United States. More recently, I think the example under the Obama administration of Obama changing the U.S. policy towards Cuba really was in large part due to pressure not only from the activist community, but the activist community helped to organize the business community that saw a lot of possibilities with trade with Cuba. Unfortunately, that opening was then reversed by Trump, but I do think it's an example that we can build on about how grassroots pressure and building a big tent of different interest groups can help to change policy.
Medea, why do you think that war has been normalized in the United States? Who benefits from perpetual war?
Certainly there are the weapons companies and the contractors to the Pentagon, and we're talking about big, big, big bucks. I mean, now it's almost $1 trillion that we're up to in terms of the Pentagon budget. And we know that they have enormous numbers of lobbyists. I spend a lot of time in Washington, D.C., and there are more lobbyists for the weapons industry than there are people in Congress. We also know that we have a system of organized bribery in our elections, where you have these very companies giving money for the reelection campaigns of Congress people, who then turn around and reward the companies with multi-billion dollar contracts. So that is one area in which there is a lot of money to be made. But in the case of the Ukraine war, we see other sectors as well, where the energy companies, the oil and gas companies, have made record profits because of this war in Ukraine, using it as a justification to get new leases from the government for expanding oil production, gas production, refineries, in order to be selling that to Europe to replace the energy that's been sanctioned that came from Russia. And so these are some examples of industries that benefit from war. Of course, for most of the people, not just the direct victims of the war, but as we see in this war in Ukraine, it's affecting people all over the world, even in the global south, where it's led to an increase of hunger because of the rise of food prices, the rise of energy prices. So there are a lot of people who have a stake in trying to end this, and a few people who get very wealthy from it.
At a recent event, Medea, one of your critics engaged in a physical assault. What do you make of the growing right-wing acceptance and use of violence in this country? Is that another factor that impedes the willingness to engage in negotiations?
Well, at that violent incident, it wasn't the right. It was people who called themselves leftists, called themselves anarchists. But in general, I think willingness to use violence and the tremendous divisiveness and hatred that we hear from the right is something extremely worrisome in this country in terms of where we are going. I also feel like the militarism we see abroad is reflected in militarism back at home. We see that the number one factor for who is going to commit a mass murder in the United States is whether they've been in the military. We also know that so many of the police who have been so abusive in their communities are people who have been in the military, where they're taught that it's a good thing to kill. So we have a very violent society. It's very worrisome about where this is going and how we can roll it back, not only in terms of regulating guns, but also in terms of just dealing with how we can give people access to the kind of mental health care they need, and the kind of ongoing reconciliation that we need in our own communities, so we learn to talk to each other about our differences instead of this kind of violent hatred that we're seeing.
Medea, speaking of differences, how would you describe current divisions within the U.S. peace movement, and what can be done to heal them?
There are huge divisions, and I have never seen this before in all my years of work since the days of the Vietnam War, of so many people who have been brought up as pacifists, as Quakers, who've worked in the peace movement for decades, and now say that this war is different. I think they should go back to the Martin Luther King quote that war is not the answer, and just keep repeating that over and over in their heads. War is not the answer. War is a lose-lose-lose situation. So we have to heal these divisions in the peace movement. And I do think, again, as time goes by, that they will be healed because people will recognize that victory is not around the corner, that this is extremely dangerous, the way this is moving, and that we're going to need everybody to come together to say that the path that we have taken and this idea of constantly sending more and more weapons into the war is not going to lead to victory, but is going to lead to a wider war.
Well, along those lines, Medea, if we don't see peace negotiations in this war, are we headed toward World War III? How dangerous is the prospect of nuclear war?
I think people don't take it seriously enough. It's quite ironic that sometimes you hear people say what a maniac Putin is, and yet on the other hand say he's just bluffing when he talks about nuclear weapons. I know that there is a general who used to be the top general to Germany for many years who said if the West helps the Ukrainians to try to take back Crimea, that Russia will use a nuclear weapon. And he just states it out like that as a fact. I think that it is extremely nerve-wracking where we are now. We should be concerned about all of the young men who are dying every single day in this ridiculous, senseless war of attrition, but also recognize how easy it could spread into a NATO country, just like months back when there was a missile that went into Poland and killed two people, and it was immediately reported that it came from Russia. Fortunately, it didn't, but the NATO countries were ready to invoke Article 5, which means they would have to get more directly involved, including sending in troops. So this war could easily extend to a NATO country, which would drag all of us into it. I know that Biden has said we're not sending in U.S. troops, we're not sending in U.S. troops, but he said, you know, we're not sending HIMARS, we're not sending tanks, we're not sending F-16s, and he's crossed every other line. So whether it's extending beyond the boundaries of Ukraine and Russia, or whether it's moving us into a catastrophic nuclear war, we should be extremely concerned, and that's one of the reasons, I think, that people should get on board with us and join the Peace in Ukraine Coalition, which they can find on peaceinukraine.org, to work with us to try to move towards peace talks.
Medea, we're unfortunately running out of our allotted time. I think that your call for people to join the movement will be urgently responded to by many of our listeners. Are there other ways that we can follow your work online?
My writing is in many different places, including Common Dreams. The actions that we promote on Code Pink are great. We have actions now not only taking out ads in places like The Hill, that's the main paper for Washington, D.C., but also in religious papers. We need people to help with donations, even small $10, $20 would be great. We need people to join the Peace in Ukraine Coalition. As I said, that's a coalition of over 100 groups right now, but individuals can join as well. And we have committees that focus on the media, on outreach, on organizing. So anybody who's listening and is concerned about where this is going, please go online, check out peaceinukraine.org, and join us.
Well, thank you so much, Medea, for your continued leadership in the peace movement all these years. You haven't slowed down one beat. And thank you also for returning to Law and Disorder.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour every Saturday, 12 p.m., where we broadcast the news that you won't find on cable. Ever wonder what Gen Z is up to? Have you heard of Generation U? Ever wonder why the old geezers are excited that something's going on since their days of living underground and avoiding the Vietnam draft? We cover these topics on the Abolitionist Hour, and we kind of give you updates on the front, whether it's Atlanta, Minneapolis, St. Louis, Kansas City. We'll keep you updated on news and information on the state of dismal prison conditions and why the Jackson County Jail is not just a stockade, it's a phone company. So join us at the Abolitionist Hour, only on Blog Talk Radio, 12 p.m. Central Standard Time. We'll see you there.
And from the plains of Royal Mead, drunk men came hurrying through, while Britannia's Huns with her long-range guns came in through the foggy dew. Back to the glen I rode again, and my heart with grief was sore. For I parted them with valiant whom I never shall see more.
Chagre prend pour nous la valse d'amour, pourtant du beau roman, c'est le dernier jour. J'ai mal, mais devant toi, je n'ose pas pleurer, puisque tout est fini avant de nous quitter. Fais-moi valser dernière fois, serre-moi tout près de moi. Dis-moi souvent de jolis mots d'amour, les mêmes qu'au premier jour. Berce-moi doucement comme un oiseau blessé dans tes bras, un instant, je veux encore rêver. Comment rappeler de mon bonheur passé, mon amour, et c'est moi, malgré que mon tourment pour toi compte, je n'ai qu'un seul désir, que tu sois heureux. Je vivrai désormais avec ton souvenir. Adieu, mon bel ami, mais avant dis-moi souvent de jolis mots d'amour, les mêmes qu'au premier jour. Berce-moi doucement comme un oiseau blessé dans tes bras, un instant de mon amour, c'est moi.
C'est...
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Amy Littlefield, The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent, who examines the consequences of the Supreme Court's ruling 1 year ago that ended women's constitutional right to obtain safe legal abortions. Shelley Altman of the group Jewish Voice for Peace, who talks about U.S. opposition to the extremist Israeli government's push to build thousands of new illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian West Bank. And investigative reporter Greg Palast, who discusses the latest ethics scandal surrounding Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito involving billionaire Paul Singer and links to Alito's deciding vote in gutting the Voting Rights Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Leftist Colombian President Gustavo Petro is pressing ahead on his pledge to make peace with armed rebel groups. Early on, he signed a series of ceasefire agreements, some of which collapsed. In early June in Havana, Cuba, Petro announced a six-month ceasefire with the National Liberation Army, or ELN, his nation's largest remaining rebel group that will begin on August 3rd. Petro, elected in 2022 on a promise to make peace with rebels and end the war on drugs, won his highest level of support in Colombia's rural conflict zones. Colombia has been engaged in a nearly six-decade-long civil conflict with government forces, paramilitary groups, left-wing rebels, and criminal networks all jostling for power. A turning point came in 2016 when the government of then-President Juan Manuel Santos signed peace accords with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, the largest rebel group at the time. Petro's ceasefire agreement with the ELN will be monitored by both the United Nations and Colombia's Catholic Church. Advocates for children are worried that government support for child care providers initiated during the COVID pandemic could be lost if funding is allowed to expire. In March 2021, Congress approved the American Rescue Plan that allocated $52 billion in block grants to child care agencies to deal with a severe labor shortage in the nation's daycare centers. The American Prospect reports that $37 billion in child care funding is expected to expire in September, which will create a serious funding gap in the child care sector, vital to the nation's future economic growth. A report from Democratic Senators Bernie Sanders and Patty Murray found that government investments since 2021 have kept daycare operators afloat. Without more federal funding, child care activists fear thousands of child care centers will be forced to close. The closures could result in $9 billion in lost wages. The impact would disproportionately fall on black women as well as their children, who would face economic instability. Chicago's incoming progressive mayor, Brandon Johnson, wants to broaden and deepen his city's green agenda. In his election campaign, Johnson, a former union organizer, laid out a strong environmental justice agenda based on a Green New Deal for housing, education, clean air, and clean water. For Johnson, this means replacing lead water pipes, retrofitting buildings, installing solar, electrifying transit, and more. In the process, Johnson said his administration would create union or prevailing wage jobs, employ people from marginalized frontline communities, and prepare young people for advanced clean energy careers. Chicago's green programs could be funded by Illinois' new state energy law and the Federal Inflation Reduction Act, both which prioritize environmental justice funding for clean energy and sustainability investments. As In These Times reports, Johnson will first have to overcome the influence wielded by polluting industries' campaign contributions to city council members that have made it difficult to pass environmental and health ordinances to protect urban neighborhoods. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
June 24th marked the one-year anniversary of the Supreme Court's extremist majority's vote to overturn the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling that established federal protections for women's reproductive rights that stood for nearly 50 years. As pro-choice and anti-abortion activists gathered in Washington, D.C. on the last weekend in June to both celebrate and protest the decision, 25 million women in the U.S. now live in states with total abortion bans or tighter restrictions. Over the past year, some Republican-controlled states have passed new laws criminalizing abortion, with some specifically targeting anyone who assists pregnant people in obtaining an abortion in other states. A recent survey conducted by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 68% of OBGYN physicians said the Supreme Court's overturning Roe v. Wade has made the management of pregnancy-related medical emergencies worse. 64% said the ruling has increased pregnancy-related mortality, and 70% believe the ruling exacerbated racial and ethnic inequities in maternal health. At the same time, a new national poll on abortion, conducted by NBC News, found that 61% of all registered voters disapprove of the Supreme Court's decision overturning Roe v. Wade. That includes nearly 8 in 10 female voters, ages 18 to 49, two-thirds of suburban women, 60% of independents, and one-third of Republican voters. Your reporter spoke with Amy Littlefield, The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent, who talks about the consequences of the high court's ruling 1 year ago that ended women's constitutional right to obtain safe, legal abortions.
So what's important to know today is that 13 states currently have bans in place on abortion, and 14 if you count Wisconsin, where there's a pre-Roe ban that abortion providers have been forced to abide by because of the ambiguity of the landscape there. Most of those states, 10 of them, are all clustered together in a row across the Deep South, starting in Texas and moving eastward, right? And we're seeing an increasing number of states, of course. You know, Ron DeSantis famously has signed a six-week ban that's looming potentially in Florida, states like North Carolina, states that were considered safe and that were a haven for people in the South that are now really under threat. And then, you know, on the flip side, of course, we see that states like New York, California, Connecticut are enacting historic protections on abortion access. Abortion is more accessible, more funded, more supported in some of these blue progressive states than it ever has been before. And in fact, National Institute for Reproductive Health put out a report. More than $200 million has been spent to support abortion and contraception and reproductive health care access in the years since Dobbs at the state and municipal level. So it is really hard to characterize the landscape in any way other than to say it depends on where you live, who you are, how much money you have to travel.
Amy, I did want to talk about the doctors, the hesitance of many of these doctors to take any risks. We have heard stories about miscarriages where women are led to believe that they must bleed out before they can get an abortion for a fetus that is either compromised or even has passed away, leaving the pregnant woman to be exposed to possible infection through sepsis or even death. Tell us about the consequences of these anti-abortion laws that are not only affecting those women who seek abortions, but for women who are yearning for a successful pregnancy but run into problems.
Absolutely. I mean, Scott, it feels like almost every day now we're seeing a new news story about a heartbreaking experience of someone with a wanted pregnancy who has suffered a miscarriage or a devastating fetal anomaly and has needed to end that pregnancy either to save her own life or because it is the most humane thing to do for her family, and where that person is denied care when they go to a hospital or see their doctor. Stories that stick with me include some of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit filed out of Texas by the Center for Reproductive Rights, you know, Amanda Zarofsky, who got so sick as a result of being denied care when she was going through a pregnancy loss that she was in the ICU and her family had to gather around by her side because they thought she was going to die. I mean, these are the stories that we're hearing. We're not hearing, you know, the stories of people who perhaps have died, for people who do not have the same access to, you know, speak with the media or lawyers as some of these plaintiffs. You know, I do think doctors are being placed in an incredibly challenging position here. In many of these states, like Texas, the anti-abortion laws are being layered on top of, you know, abortion stigma. They're being layered on top of existing religious restrictions if it's a Catholic or, you know, Christian hospital. So there's an enormous amount of confusion, and no one has really been able to lay out clearly for them exactly how they're supposed to interpret that law. I think, unfortunately, what's happening in a lot of these states like Texas is that OBGYNs are finding that they are in an impossible position where they can't provide the standard of care to their patients because of these bans, and a lot of them are leaving. And that's going to leave care deserts in places that already have high rates of maternal mortality, especially for Black women and people of color.
Pro-choice activists have been very successful at statewide referendums just this past November in the midterm elections. Tell us a little bit about the success they had. Was surprising to many that deeply red or conservative states, by substantial numbers, passed these referendums that blocked making abortions illegal in those states. What's the hope for the future on the route of referendums?
I think that abortion rights groups really see ballot initiatives as their most promising tactic to restore abortion access in some of these red states. With the huge caveat that the process is different everywhere, and that in a lot of these Republican gerrymandered states, the state legislatures have tried to make it more difficult for these measures to actually pass. And we're seeing that in Ohio right now. Republicans are just trying to make it more difficult to pass a ballot initiative in response to the fact that activists there are trying to put abortion on the ballot. And doctors, I should say, not all of them are activists. This is a place where a lot of doctors have gotten involved as well in trying to change the law in their favor. So I think we're going to see a lot more ballot initiatives on abortion rights. I mean, I was there in Kansas last summer right after the Dobbs decision in August when they had a special election where this anti-abortion measure was expected to pass in deep ruby red Kansas, and it was defeated. And the momentum there was enormous. The energy was huge. I felt like I was really seeing what happens when the pro-choice majority finds its voice and gets mobilized. And then, of course, we saw the same thing happen in Kentucky, in California, in Vermont. And so with six ballot initiatives all going towards the pro-choice side, I think there's enormous momentum, and Democrats are finally catching on to the fact that abortion is a winning issue. And so I think we're going to see, you know, Ohio is working on it, South Dakota, Missouri, Florida, and beyond, states where we're going to see abortion on the ballot, and that being sort of the place where a lot of state organizing and momentum and energy is building.
That was Amy Littlefield, The Nation magazine's abortion access correspondent. Find a link to her recent Nation cover story titled "The Message They've Received Is That You Don't Deserve to Be Cared For, Life on the Abortion Borderland, and Other Commentary" by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent weeks, Israel has carried out its most violent attacks on Palestinians living in the West Bank since the Second Intifada, or uprising, that ended 20 years ago. Palestinians have also attacked Israeli settlers and residents of Israel proper. In the escalating violence, 170 Palestinians, including 26 children, and 19 Israelis, have been reported killed so far in 2023. Earlier this year, Israel approved construction of more than 7,000 new housing units for settlers in the West Bank that will increase the Israeli population in the occupied territory above 500,000. These settlements are considered illegal under international law and undermine the two-state solution that successive U.S. presidential administrations have long claimed to support. According to the Israel-based group Peace Now, the Israeli government is now pushing at an unprecedented pace towards the full annexation of the Palestinian West Bank. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Shelley Altman, chairperson of the New Haven, Connecticut chapter of Jewish Voice for Peace, which has 400,000 members across the U.S. Here he discusses the latest actions of the most extreme right-wing government in Israel's history and what Jewish and other supporters of Palestine in the U.S. are doing to oppose Israel's expansionist policy.
There are really three important things that I think have to be noted. The first is that Israelis elected this leadership. The leadership is not you know, the result of a coup or anything like that, Israelis elected this leadership in an election last November. The second is that here in the United States, every time that Israel does something that people are upset about, our government, whether it's the administration or members of Congress or other people in leadership positions, they express concern, they express deep concern, they say they're deeply troubled. This week, Antony Blinken, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, said that the settlement decision was an obstacle to the horizon of hope, but that we still have an ironclad relationship with Israel, and we will have that forever. And so this sets the stage for settlement expansion and for impunity in the face of the concern and the condemnation. Nothing is ever done here in the United States to present any consequences for Israel's actions. So there's a couple of things that happen. One is the settlements tend to be positioned in a way to further fragment the land in the West Bank so that it's harder and harder for Palestinians in the West Bank to get from one place to another. With regard to your question about Palestinian state or however that played out, it makes it more and more impossible for that to happen because the settlements are just completely dividing up any kind of territory that Palestinians would be able to have as part of a state or part of whatever political entity that was agreed to.
Shelley Altman, what is Jewish Voice for Peace doing regarding addressing all these ongoing crises?
We at JVP Action, the political side of Jewish Voice for Peace, had meetings in Congress with members of Congress or with their aides earlier this month. And the first thing you hear is Iran, that there's no interest in solving the problem between Israel and Palestine, with addressing the human rights violations, with addressing the land grabs, with addressing the home demolitions, with addressing any of that. The interest is in manipulating the political situation in the Middle East so that Iran does not get more power than it already has in the Middle East. And if making a deal with the egregious human rights violator such as Saudi Arabia, that's okay. You know, that's okay to make Israel happy, to sell arms, and to shut down Iran. There are several pieces of legislation that we spoke to our members of Congress and their aides about. One of them is H.R. 3103, which is a Betty McCollum-sponsored bill to basically assure that any aid that we give to Israel is not used for abuse of children through arrests and detentions. The second piece is to not allow those funds to be used for home demolitions or destruction of homes for Palestinian families. And the third is to not allow those funds to be used for annexation. And the chances of that legislation, you know, passing and getting signed by the president are zero, at least in this Congress. But the intention is to build up a base of support for consequences and for promoting human rights and for making people aware in our government of what's going on and how we need to take steps to say, no, this is not what we are and this is not what we are going to support. One other thing I do want to say, and this sort of gets back to is a little bit to impunity, is that you've probably heard of the Israeli finance minister whose name is Bezalel Smotrich. And he's the finance minister, but he's also in charge of civil administration in the West Bank. He's the man who called for the town of Huwara to be erased from the map when settlers invaded it earlier this year in March. He has refused to call the settler pogroms in the Palestinian towns terror. He's argued that basically they're brothers and they're fighting the common enemy, namely Palestine. And basically, Israel has just changed the way that they do the settlements so that it used to be that the power over the settlements was with the Israeli military because it's a military occupation. But that's now been changed so that the power is basically controlled by the civilian administration, which is Smotrich, whose stated intent is to remove all Palestinians.
That was Shelley Altman, chair of the New Haven, Connecticut chapter of the national group Jewish Voice for Peace. Learn more about the root causes of the escalating violence in Israel-Palestine and the work of Jewish Voice for Peace by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. after weeks of news reports revealing a series of ethics scandals surrounding U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas for his acceptance of extravagant gifts from conservative billionaire Harlan Crow, the Pulitzer Prize-winning online news site ProPublica has uncovered more apparent ethics violations, this time by Justice Samuel Alito. ProPublica reports that in 2008, Justice Alito accepted a seat in a private plane owned by Republican megadonor Paul Singer, which flew him to Alaska for a luxury fishing trip hosted by another right-wing businessman. Alito failed to declare such gifts or recuse himself when Singer had business before the court. Thus far, Chief Justice John Roberts has resisted calls to institute ethics rules for the Supreme Court or testify in Congress about the Thomas Crow affair. Your reporter spoke with investigative journalist Greg Palast, New York Times best-selling author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Here, Palast, who's investigated hedge fund billionaire Paul Singer's ruthless financial schemes that have brought misery to millions in the Congo, Argentina, and Peru, talks about how Alito was the Supreme Court's deciding vote that gutted the 1965 Voting Rights Act, an outcome in which Singer had invested millions of his fortune.
Paul Singer, let's say who he is. Okay, he's known as the Vulture. While I've given him the name the Vulture, everyone uses it. I've been hunting this guy since 2007 for BBC television. I've literally tracked him from Africa to Asia to Latin America to Detroit, Michigan, one of the third world countries he's attacked. He's known as the Vulture. He runs a vulture fund. It's called a vulture fund. That I didn't make up. It's actually called a vulture fund, whose job is to take dying companies, dying nations, and, by the way, dying people. He's kind of like a repo man who takes old debts and then does whatever it takes. And I mean whatever it takes. In most cases, his activities are illegal, whatever it takes to collect basically a pound of flesh from his victims. 2008, we find out that he has a couple private jets, a couple of them, and he takes politicians, judges, you name it, for free rides. You know, a seat on a private jet from New York to Alaska is about $100,000, usually, given free to Alito. I love Alito's line that if he didn't take it, the seat would have been empty. One, I'm very disappointed in ProPublica, for one thing, for only looking at one single case. And they said, well, and Alito made the point, okay, there was one case in which he was directly named as a plaintiff that the court ruled on in 2000, you know, just a couple of years after the trip where Singer went with Alito, Justice Alito, also the head of the Federal Society. That's very important because if you're a judge and there's a Republican administration, you basically have to be approved by the Federal Society. So if you're a judge, you're looking at this. You want to move up to the Supreme Court. You see Singer and the head of the Federal Society and the Supreme Court justice with this vulture, you're going to pleasure this vulture because he's the guy who can give you a judgeship. He's like the new Roy Cohn picking our judges for us. That's very important. But he voted in a case where, I mean, I don't think that they found a legal scholar yet who said that he shouldn't have recused himself, removed himself from a case. So that's the immediate ProPublica story. That's only the beginning of the way this guy's operating. The most important case to me, Scott, frankly, is that it was Singer who pushed the case Shelby v. Holder. Singer's the big money and the power behind the Manhattan Institute. And they ran and funded with the Koch brothers. So Singer and the Koch brothers, hand in hand, they often work in coordination. Singer's far more right-wing than the Koch brothers, I should note. Singer, through the Manhattan Institute, pushed Shelby v. Holder. Now, that actually yesterday happened to be the 10th anniversary of Shelby v. Holder. And that's the case that basically gutted the Voting Rights Act. And that was Paul Singer, and that was a 5-4 vote. What they said about the Argentina vote, yeah, maybe Alito shouldn't have been on that case, but it was a 7-1 decision. Well, that's only a minor case that he was involved with. Shelby v. Holder, which has entirely changed our political landscape, making it much, much more difficult for people of color to vote. Much more difficult. And that was a 5-4 decision. Alito should not have been on that.
Greg, public confidence in the U.S. Supreme Court is at its lowest since 1973. And this follows a string of revelations about Justice Clarence Thomas and the lavish trips and gifts that he's received from other billionaires. Tell us a bit about, from your perspective here, what should the American people conclude from all this money or gifts changing hands between the wealthiest people in the country and the Supreme Court justices?
People still think of the Supreme Court as these wise, you know, you watch TV, you know, judges in their wise robes and they're always judicious. The Supreme Court, it's already been decaying. I should note that Paul Singer also gave free rides, these free $100,000 seat hunting trips to Justice Scalia before then. You know, where, and there were a lot of 5-4 decisions for, you know, on creating, remember, we didn't have, until Scalia was on the court, we didn't have, the Second Amendment was never, never, ever in the court's history interpreted the right to own a gun, personally. There was never a right to own guns in the Constitution, never recognized by the court. And Scalia pulled that off on a 5-4 decision. He was also pleasured by Singer. So you have basically our Supreme Court of our land, our final arbiter on the Constitution, has been corrupted. And it's getting more corrupt and more ideologic and less judicious. So it's been a decayed court for a long time. People are just waking up to it.
That was investigative journalist Greg Pallast, New York Times best-selling author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Pallas' new award-winning film, Vigilante, Georgia's Vote Suppression Hitman, will premiere next year. Find links to Pallas' articles on hedge fund billionaire Paul Singer by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.